you get tired. There's no avenue that's given you directly to do what you need to do. No one can explain to you what to do. They tell you it takes time. Well, how much time? They tell you to vote, and we vote, and we're going to keep voting. We have to change these laws, and we have to do something, because we've come up to this point to where the whole world is seeing the two systems of justice, and we're not in the mood nor in the mindset of taking it anymore.
Jacob Blake,
what are we to do?
We're going to continue this discussion. We ask you to stay with us, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Jacob Blake Sr., father of Jacob Blake Jr., shot 7 times by a police officer in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm Amy Goodman with Noreen Shea.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Crossing Boundaries, virtual fishing derby and auction from Saturday, September 26th through Sunday, October 4th, streaming online. This fundraiser for the conservation of Pacific Northwest salmon and steelhead features a virtual fishing derby, auction, trivia night, and more. Again, that's Crossing Boundaries, virtual fishing derby and auction from Saturday, September 26th through Sunday, October 4th, streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm a going fishing, mama's going fishing, and the baby going fishing too.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Portland police make 13 arrests after protesters take to the streets outraged over the decision in the Breonna Taylor case. An Oregon senator mourns the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and warns her passing could also threaten the Affordable Care Act. And in Washington, a promising trial for a COVID vaccine is calling out for millions to sign up. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 24th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. A demonstration of people demanding that police stop killing black people came to an end last night after a few protesters targeted a police building with fire and rocks. According to police accounts, someone threw a Molotov cocktail. Portland police say 2 officers suffered minor injuries, and then they ended up making 13 arrests. Police ordered hundreds of people who gathered in honor of Breonna Taylor to leave, and then forced them to go. Cell phone video from protesters document that federal officers joined in, shooting impact munitions on downtown streets about a half mile away from the federal courthouse. For the first time since September 5th, police declared the protest a riot. The demonstrations started hours earlier, after Kentucky's top lawyer announced that Louisville police officers would not face any charges for killing the 26-year-old Breonna Taylor. Officers shot and killed the emergency room technician back in March in her home under a no-knock warrant. Several black women in Portland addressed a crowd of hundreds of people in front of the Downtown Justice Center, encouraging them to vote and to continue pressing for change. The number of new coronavirus cases in Oregon took a steep climb today. Dozens of workplaces in the state are dealing with hundreds of infections, and meantime, colleges and universities are resorting to quarantines to cope with rapidly rising outbreaks. KBOO's Annette Newell has these stories in today's COVID-19 update.
The Oregon Health Authority reports that COVID-19 has claimed two more lives in Oregon, raising the state's death toll to 539. The state reported 382 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 today, bringing the state total to 31,865. The new cases are spread across 28 counties. Multnomah County led the state with 92 new cases. Washington followed with 50 more, then Marion with 48, and Clackamas with 32. Today's case count is the highest since mid-July. The health authority says it's a reminder of the importance of staying 6 feet apart from each other, wearing a face covering when 6 feet of physical distance cannot be maintained, and limiting the size of gatherings. There are 61 active COVID-19 workplace outbreaks in Oregon this week. That's five fewer than last week. Nine deaths have been associated with workplace outbreaks in Oregon during the pandemic. The largest workplace outbreak is at the Snake River Correctional Institution in Ontario. It started on June 24th, and the case count has continued to rise since then. There have been 436 coronavirus cases linked to the outbreak, with the most recent reported on September 16th. 314 COVID-19 cases are connected to the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution in Umatilla County. Another 186 cases are linked to Lamb Weston in Hermiston. 110 cases are connected to Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla, and another 72 cases are tied to Shearer's Foods in Hermiston. Colleges that have reopened for in-person classes are struggling with the rapid spread of the coronavirus among tens of thousands of students. They're imposing tough social distancing rules and using technologies like virus tracking apps. But their major dilemma is what to do with students who test positive for the virus or who come in contact with someone who has. So many campuses are subjecting students to quarantines. Many public and private colleges have set aside special dormitories, or they're renting off-campus apartments or hotel rooms for infected students and separate quarantine units for those who might be sick. That strategy is supported by Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert. He says it is better to separate students until they're no longer contagious rather than sending them home where they might infect their family and friends. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
A major COVID-19 vaccine trial is about to begin based out of Washington State, and researchers need millions of volunteers for the vaccine's trial registry. As Suzanne Potter reports, they'll be winnowed down to a select 30 to 60,000 people.
A fourth major clinical trial for a COVID vaccine debuted on Wednesday, and public health experts are asking for your help. Millions of volunteers are needed to aid in the effort, but so far just 410,000 people have signed up. COVID-19 Prevention Network Executive Director Dr. Jim Kublin says everyone is going to benefit from these vaccines, so we should all be willing to pitch in.
We desperately need the general public to volunteer for these vaccine clinical trials. This is a tremendous way for people to step up and really accomplish their civic duty by contributing to the advancement of these COVID vaccines.
It takes about 5 minutes to enter your information on the website preventcovid.org. No one in the trial will be infected with the virus itself. If you are chosen, you'll be given an injection of either a placebo or of the possible vaccine and be studied for several years. Side effects are usually limited to redness and swelling at the injection site. Kublin says they need adult volunteers from all walks of life and every ethnic group, but they especially encourage the elderly and people of color to sign up.
We're encouraging all communities, but particularly those disproportionately impacted, to join us in this national and global effort.
Hundreds of sites are activated every week, so it's not too late to get involved. Study participants are paid for their time, usually a few $100s. A growing anti-vaccine movement has questioned the safety or effectiveness of some immunizations in recent years. Patients are advised to consult their doctor with any concerns. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Governor Kate Brown says Oregon is entering a new phase of its fight against devastating wildfires. She says firefighters are getting more control of the main fires, and wetter weather has moved in with more on the horizon. Three major fires are contained enough that the state's passing the responsibility back to local fire districts. There are still 7 major wildfires burning across the state, but all are at least somewhat contained. The Oregon Department of Forestry expects the big fires to keep burning until heavy rain arrives, which will likely happen in mid-October. 9 people have died in the Oregon fires, and 5 more are still missing. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden paid tribute to Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He also warned that health care protections are at risk, with President Trump naming her successor. Here's part of what he told his fellow senators.
President, as our colleagues have said tonight, we can't even remember any other member of the federal judiciary who became a cultural icon recognized only by their initials. RBG did, and she earned her recognition and her place in history through an astounding career fighting for gender equality, for the rights of LGBTQ individuals, for the rights of everybody who had been pushed to the margins of American society. Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump have now, unfortunately, made it very clear that they're going to pull out all the stops to unravel the exceptional work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And they're going to break their own rule. Their own rule. This is not something that was debated with the other side. They decided to break their own rule pertaining to election year appointments to undo the historical record of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And for a moment, Madam President, I want to compare this to another time. When I was a young man, right out of law school, I served for a number of years as co-director of the Oregon Gray Panthers at home. And back then, just like now, there were a lot of issues that were on people's mind. Just like today, where there's a list of issues miles long. From the rights of LGBTQ plus Americans to workers' rights to the ability of every eligible American to vote and much more. And there was a similarly long list of issues back when I worked with the senior citizens. I made the judgment then because of spending that time with older people, that health care was far and away, Madam President, colleagues, the most important issue. Because if you and your loved ones don't have your health, then pretty much everything else goes by the board. You can't spend time with family. You can't achieve all you want in your job. You can't even have the chance to walk about outside on a pleasant evening like this. So health care, to me and to millions of Americans, is far and away the most important issue in front of this body. And now this is the one issue that will come up immediately with a Trump-backed lawsuit going before the court soon after the election. So make no mistake about it. And I know it's awfully hard to follow all the legalese and the procedural motions. At one point, my wife said, I think Senator Merkley may have heard this, my wife said she would marry me. She said, "You are a lawyer. Not probably a particularly good one, but I was sure glad you did a good job for the senior citizens. But it's hard to follow all the legalese and all the procedure. But when you set aside all of that surrounding the fact that healthcare will be the one issue coming up immediately with a Trump-backed lawsuit soon after the election, tonight we say to the American people that healthcare in America is at stake. The Affordable Care Act is at stake. Coverage for 130 million Americans with pre-existing conditions is at stake. If you don't trust Republicans with your health care, you cannot trust Republicans with this Supreme Court seat. Donald Trump and the Justice Department are suing to have the entire Affordable Care Act thrown out. Every last bit of it thrown out. So, I just want to walk through what this means from sea to shining sea. If they're successful, the ironclad guarantee coverage for pre-existing conditions is gone. The ban on discrimination against women is gone. The ban on annual and lifetime limits, gone. Coverage for young people on their parents' plans, gone.
That was Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden speaking on the U.S. Senate floor about the passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how her successor could affect the fate of the Affordable Care Act. City leaders have ordered a boil water notice for part of southern Salem, near where a water main broke Wednesday afternoon. About 1,000 homes had a water pressure interruption when the water main broke in the Croizon area near Madrona Avenue South. City leaders say it is a precautionary measure, and they're telling people only to use boiled water for drinking, brushing teeth, washing fruits and vegetables, preparing food and baby formula, making ice, and cleaning food contact surfaces. Their instructions are to bring water to a rolling boil for 1 minute, then allow the water to cool before using it. Water should be stored in a clean container with a cover. You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30. We'll hear Coast Range Radio exploring environmental justice in rural Oregon. At 6, we'll hear Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with periods of light rain and a low of 57. Tomorrow we'll see more rain and a high of 61. Today in history, on this date in 1789, the first Supreme Court was established when Congress passed the Judiciary Act. The quote of the day is from the first Supreme Court Justice John Jay. He said, quote, "Among the many objects to which a wise and free people find it necessary to direct their attentions, that of providing for their safety seems to be the first." A new report highlights the importance of keeping guns away from the polls, and Florida wants an investigation of a fund to help pay returning citizens court fees and fines so they can vote. With more on these stories, we go to Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Justice can be evasive. If you look like Brianna, or if you come from where I come from, we know history tells us to not hold our breath, but to do the work.
That's Kentucky State Representative Charles Booker, Protesters took to the street nationwide in response to a grand jury's decision to charge one of the police officers involved in the shooting death of Breonna Taylor with, quote, wanton endangerment, unquote, of her three neighbors. In Louisville, police reportedly used force against protesters, and arrests began before the 9 p.m. curfew. President Trump and his allies have been stoking fear about violence in cities, blaming it on demonstrators and political opponents, and even defending armed counter-protesters. Booker says it's a strategy.
That law and order narrative you hear, even from the highest office in the land, that is intentional. It's not about making sure that we get true justice. It's not about addressing the real challenges we face. It's about hurting people.
Footage surfaced in Louisville of men in khakis, bulletproof vests, and with rifles, reportedly local right-wing militia members. Joshua Horowitz with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence says these tactics have also been used on lawmakers, like the armed protests at the Michigan State Capitol over a mask mandate this summer.
We have seen the rise of guns, especially armed right-wing militias, who have been showing up at peaceful protests, trying to intimidate protesters.
The coalition, partnering with Guns Down America, released a report yesterday urging stronger bans on guns in polling places.
Everybody has a fundamental right to vote, and we think it's important that people be able to access polling places without intimidation. This report is part of a campaign to educate local election officials about what they can do to safeguard their polling places from armed intimidation.
The report focused on Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin.
We think that it's best to be prepared. We're not trying to scare people from the polls at all.
In Florida, Republican state leadership wants an investigation into whether a national fundraising campaign violates state law, charging it's a political inducement. The Florida Rights Restoration Coalition has raised $20 million to pay back court fees and fines so people with past felony convictions can register to vote. Desmond Mead, the coalition's founder, says it's not a partisan effort.
And I am proud to be a registered voter, and I want other people to feel what it feels like to walk into that voting booth and to be able to cast that ballot, understanding that they're walking into a sacred place, committing a sacred act.
Senate Republicans' investigation of Joe Biden's son reports Hunter, quote, cashed in, unquote, on his father's name for business deals, and his involvement with the Ukrainian energy company gave the appearance of a conflict of interest, but concluded there was no evidence of wrongdoing by the former vice president. And a correction, the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be lying in state at the Capitol this Friday. She's currently lying in repose at the Supreme Court. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, one of every four children in the United States could face hunger this year. But now, an unusual partnership works to feed hungry kids. Andrea Sears has the story.
A group battling childhood hunger has enlisted a major media company to help get meals to kids while schools are closed by the COVID pandemic. Turn Up Fight Hunger is an unusual collaboration between the No Kids Hungry campaign and Discovery Incorporated. In less than a year, the partnership has helped connect children across the country with more than 520 million meals. And with many schools closed, the task of getting food to kids has grown even harder. According to Elaney Towns with the No Kid Hungry campaign, since the pandemic began, as many as one in four face hunger.
Kids need food to learn and to grow healthy, but districts across Pennsylvania are facing really significant challenges in terms of having to reach those kids.
She says when schools first closed earlier this year, No Kid Hungry invested more than $27 million in schools and community groups nationwide. Alexa Verveer at Discovery says their slate of TV programs reaches one of every four women in the U.S., so they decided it was a good fit to spread the message and spur action.
We can bring a passionate audience on the Discovery side, coupled with expertise on our nonprofit partner side, to deliver on doing something that's truly meaningful.
She says the Turn Up Fight Hunger five-year goal is to get 1 billion meals to kids across the country. Towns points out that charitable groups can't do it all. Government programs play an important role fighting food insecurity for lower-income families.
We've been advocating strongly to extend waivers and flexibility at the federal level to allow schools to adapt meal programs to meet the need, and really making sure that other federal programs like SNAP or Pandemic EBT or WIC also have the flexibilities to meet the need of low-income parents.
Towns adds that No Kid Hungry has committed to investing another $35 million this fall to help ensure that kids who have depended on school meal programs get enough to eat. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Public hearings about the Keystone XL pipeline are set for next week. The United Tribes of Bristol Bay call for a stop of the Pebble Mine, and Native advocates praised the moment of some new legislation. With these stories and more, we go to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Public hearings begin next week for Keystone XL pipeline water crossing permits. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is considering permits for pipeline construction through South Dakota, Montana, and Nebraska. The Corps is holding hearings by phone due to COVID-19. Victoria Wicks reports.
Earlier this year, a Montana judge found Corps of Engineers water permits for the Keystone XL pipeline to be in violation of the National Environmental Protection Act. TransCanada and the Corps asked the U.S. Supreme Court for an emergency overruling, but the High Court declined. That left TransCanada with no options for a fast permit. The company and the Corps have an appeal before the Ninth Circuit, but that won't play out before the November presidential election, and there's a chance the appeals court might uphold the Montana decision. And so TransCanada applied to the Corps of Engineers for a more thoroughly vetted permit while it waits for the Ninth Circuit ruling. Part of the permitting process under NEPA includes public input, and that's the purpose behind the upcoming hearings. The public notice put out by the Corps indicates its jurisdiction is limited to effects on water and wetlands. State officials from the South Dakota Department of Environment and Natural Resources and Nebraska Department of Environment and Energy will also listen into the federal hearings. They'll include the testimony in their review of previously issued state certification under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act, which controls water quality. The Montana Department of Environmental Quality is holding its own 401 hearings on November 16th. People calling in to comment are limited to 3 minutes of testimony. The record will remain open for 10 days after each hearing for written comment. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The executive director of the United Tribes of Bristol Bay, Alana Hurley, says change in leadership at the Pebble Limited Partnership does not address any real issues with the permitting process or political influence of the Pebble Mine Project in Bristol Bay, Alaska. Her statement follows news of the resignation of Pebble Partnership CEO Tom Collier, who resigned in light of comments made claiming political sway with elected leaders and federal regulators, which were secretly recorded by an environmental group and made public this week. The company backing the project announced his resignation Wednesday. Bristol Bay tribes are calling for swift action by U.S. lawmakers to stop the proposed open-pit gold and copper mine, which they say threatens fisheries, land, and water. Native advocates are praising movement on legislation to address missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and are hopeful to see more progress and policies to strengthen protections for tribal communities. Mike Moen has more.
Earlier this week, Congress gave final approval to Savannah's Act, which addresses cases of missing and murdered Indigenous people. It orders the Justice Department to develop guidelines to solve and prevent these cases while establishing data collection. Lisa Casares of North Dakota Native Vote says the public finally is noticing that Natives are easily targeted for horrific crimes and that this will hopefully bring some solace.
It's considered positive considering, you know, this has been a longstanding issue within Indian country that, you know, the missing and murdered Indigenous women and Indigenous people.
The bill is named after Savannah Graywind, a pregnant Native American woman who was brutally murdered in 2017. Her body was found along the North Dakota-Minnesota border. Indigenous women face more violence than any other group. The National Institute of Justice says at least 84% of these women have been the target of sexual or other violence in their lifetimes. I'm Mike Moen.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Lau and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Andrea Sears. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming and become a member, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Listening to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Located in Western Oregon, the Coast Range Association works to build just and sustainable communities that provide for people in the natural world. You can reach me at andrew@coastrange.org. To hear past episodes of Coast Range Radio, go to coastrange.org/coastrangeradio. You can also download and subscribe to Coast Range Radio on your podcast service of choice. This episode features my discussion with environmental justice leader Jolie Boa of CAUSA, Oregon's immigrant rights organization. Super excited today to be speaking with Jolie Boa. Joel is the coalition manager for CAUSA Oregon, Oregon's immigrant rights organization. Joel currently serves as chair of the Eugene Human Rights Commission. Joel is also the youngest person to be elected chair for the Oregon Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force. Hey, Joel, thank you so much for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andrew. Really excited to be here.
I hope you're doing well during this really unprecedented time, intense social upheaval and COVID-19, and I'm sure your work at CAUSA has been impacted by that and been pretty intense. I was hoping you'd maybe, you know, give folks who are listening maybe what is going on with Oregon's immigrant communities today. How can they help? How can they be involved? And maybe just a little about what is CAUSA.
CAUSA was formed in 1995 by immigrant rights champions and leaders, and it came out. We sort of formed as an organization as a result of an anti-immigrant initiative petition in the mid 90s, and so some of the immigrant rights leaders at the time sort of were like seeing this threat, this emerging threat of anti-immigrant sentiment trying to make its way through policy. And so CAUSA was born. You know, our mission is to make the lives of Latinx immigrants and their families better, and to give them, you know, the opportunities and freedom this country has to offer. And we do that through coalition building, advocacy, and leadership engagement. And so we've got, you know, that's our mission. So now that COVID has hit, you know, we have such incredible infrastructure and such great partners across the state. And so when COVID hit, the first thing I did was say, you know, let's pull the groups from the One Oregon Coalition that are directly serving immigrants and have them hop on a call. Well, it was about 50 or 60 of us. And I just went through each region. And I was like, hey, how y'all? Like, how's everyone feeling? How's the community doing? And, you know, each region by region, obviously things were a little different. You know, so like the coastal folks and more rural folks were like, hey, there's nothing at grocery stores, you know, people can't. And then but in general, right, like everyone had the same concerns. We can't pay rent. How do we take our kids to school/childcare? But we were able to do that quickly. We were able to hop on that call fast because of the previous work we had done on driver's licenses and on Measure 105. And what was born out of that, basically we've received $20 million from the state of Oregon to give economic relief to immigrants without legal status who have lost their jobs. And so up to date, we've given almost $10 million to immigrants in Oregon without legal status who've lost their job and have not been able to get economic relief from the federal government. And that was possible because of the infrastructure we had been put in place, right? We were already ready, so we didn't have to get ready. We just had to pull the trigger.
Is it the truth, or is it happening that immigrant communities in Oregon are being more affected by the disease itself?
Definitely. It's definitely true. I mean, there's a lot of things compounding here, right? I mean, in general, immigrants in Oregon are the fastest growing population in Oregon. They have been for quite some time. And, you know, depending on what county you're in, there's immigrants themselves and then there's immigrants with mixed status, right? So the immigrants without legal status, those are the most vulnerable folks, right? Because if they lose their job, they don't qualify for unemployment insurance, right? They and not just that, but it's also the work that they do, right? So like all across the United States, even here in Oregon, you know, the jobs that immigrants partake in that keep the state afloat, that you know, from farming to forestry to meatpacking facilities to nurseries, right, to fisheries and canneries. It's work that's done in close proximity to another person. And so a lot of what's been happening is that, you know, even in sawmills too, right, like a lot of sawmills, there's been outbreaks. And so part of our concern has been like, yeah, we want to give people economic relief. But we've also pushing really hard to try and get some protections, some like real protections and access to masks, to farm workers, forest workers, other agricultural workers. So we just actually secured another $10 million for something called the Quarantine Fund. And the Quarantine Fund basically is, you know, you'll be able to access it regardless of your legal status, you know, if you have status, you don't have status. If you are an agricultural worker, which includes people who work in fisheries, canneries, nurseries, forest workers, right? The sort of broad range, cattle farms, the broad range of agricultural work. You'll be able to access a quarantine fund so that if you get sick, you can actually quarantine and protect yourself, protect your coworkers, but also not lose out on economic benefits. Because if you're a person who's taking care of your family, you get COVID, you're the sole breadwinner in your family, you're not going to want to give that up. So we just establish an additional $10 million for a quarantine fund so that, especially right now that it's harvest season, man. Like, you know, people are out in the fields and they're really trying hard to make sure that those harvests don't go to waste. But if someone gets sick, they need to quarantine, right? Because then everyone gets sick and then the whole thing goes belly up. So we definitely have, you know, we have concerns about that, and also just RealD data in general. So RealD stands for race, ethnicity, language, and disability. And so those are markers that are important when it comes to public health outcomes, because they are intersections in which, you know, if you are a person with disability, you are immunocompromised, right? If it's not, and the race component, ethnicity component, and not necessarily like because you're a certain race, you're more likely to get something. It's the experience of being a person of that race that puts you at high risk, right? So people are like, well, why do black or brown folks? It's like, no, it's not because they're black and brown. It's because it's the experience of what being a black or brown person in the United States of America puts you at risk at, right? Being close to point source pollution, you know, being working in a job that is highly taxing on your immune system or exposes you to certain chemicals. Right, it lowers your, you know, the stress of, you know, right, all the compounding things that have effects on our health makes us more vulnerable to getting this disease.
Definitely, and so that's a perfect segue into your work with the Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force. What is, maybe for folks who maybe aren't familiar with that term, briefly, what is environmental justice, and what are you doing as the chair of the task force? What do you all are working on to, you know, sure, address these really important, deeply interconnected issues?
You know, the environmental justice, for the folks, you know, who are listening in, is essentially it's the principle that no one should have to disproportionately bear the burden of environmental health hazards and toxins, right? And people who do experience that, the term is called environmental racism. And, you know, that term really popped up in the 80s. And sort of the beginning advocacy against environmental racism, environmental justice, actually started, you know, back in the 60s with sanitation workers, you know, garbage workers in the South. You know, I know one of the last campaigns that MLK did was, you know, for sanitation workers. So in many ways, the modern environmental justice movement, you know, sort of started in the 60s. But, you know, it really sort of started flying off the handle in the 90s after 94 when Clinton signed an executive order on environmental justice. And then the governor's environmental justice task force is the first task force of its kind in the nation. It was formed in 2008. And the idea was that the governor would have a task force in which the 14 natural resource state agencies that are under the purview of the governor's office would be beholden to the environmental justice task force and would be required to attend quarterly meetings where they could learn about environmental justice issues across the state, but also where they would have an opportunity to sort of come to the task force and say, here's how we're changing our policies and practices to reduce environmental health hazards or increase environmental justice in the state of Oregon. And that's really been sort of the mission. But, you know, I first came onto the task force in 2014 as an advocate for environment, 2015 as an advocate for environmental justice. You know, I sort of was pushing them to do a little bit more than what they were doing, and eventually, you know, was able to work with one of the commissioners at the time to do a forum in Medford, you know. And at the time, for like almost 7-8 years, they were only meeting in Salem and Portland, and I was like, y'all need to meet other places in the state. And they said, and the guy was like, okay, we'll try to do one in Medford, you know, but we need your help organizing it, because it is a volunteer board. So that's part of the difficulty of doing this work, is, you know, all these EJ champions have other full-time gigs, and so yeah. this is like another thing. But we were able to organize something. So, you know, 15, I was able to get other organizations and workers, farm workers, forest workers, and hotel workers to come and testify to the task force about their experience with chemical exposure. And that's what really sort of started my, you know, that's what really kicked off my career. And, you know, from there we were able to go to the Democratic Summit and talk to, you know, legislators. You know, eventually culminated and we were invited to come speak to the Senate Workforce Committee down the line. After we did a series of earned media with forest workers. And so we actually had forest workers come up and testify in Spanish about their experiences in the forest. And just as a full caveat, that was the first job my father did when he came to this country.
Really?
As a forest worker. Yeah. Yeah. So my dad planted trees and I grew up hearing about sort of the awful, really hard work that's done in the forest and how dangerous of a job it is. But eventually, you know, I kept pushing the task force more, like, you know, do more. And then eventually they were like, hey man, why don't you apply to be on it and see if such a great idea. And so I did, right? I applied and I first inducted in 15. I got on the task force in the fall of 2016. And then in the fall of 17, I remember we were at a meeting in Madras and I was like, talking, and the chair at the time, Ben Duncan, who was one of the founding members, he was like, I'm gonna step down and I wanna nominate Joel to be the chair. And I kind of sitting there with my mouth open, I was like, okay. Right. and so, you know, I was nominated and voted chair unanimously, and that was the fall of 17. I've been chair ever since. And so, you know, since then we've done a number of things. We've traveled, I think, to every region of the state. You know, in the fall of 18, I had an opportunity to go down to Klamath Falls and, you know, talk to Chair Don Gentry of the Klamath Tribes and also hear from, I think we had 6 or 7 tribes from across the state in Northern California come and testify to us about the LNG pipeline. You know, I've had conversations with folks about forest fires. I've had conversations with folks about, you know, noise pollution and air pollution. So, you know, that since 17 or six, fall of 16, I've been in the task force. You know, it's been almost like 4 years and I've been chair for the last 3, and I've learned quite a lot. And I've also, you know, just sort of seen how big the problem is and how much more advocacy we need. But the exciting thing is that EJ's really taken a foothold. I mean, since I started in 15, I've seen a lot more EJ organizations and EJ positions pop up. And that's because I think there's this recognition, especially as climate justice has become like a big movement. You know, I think more now than ever, it's the government's job to ensure that that people have a chance to pursue what we were all promised, right? I think at the end of the day, like my sort of ethos has been like, you know, if we were all promised the American dream, which is the ability to pursue, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you know, what's standing in the way of that? And the list is long, man.
Yeah, and that kind of gets me to my next question and some of these bigger issues that we're talking about, all the interconnections of this work that you've been doing in all these different arenas, but they're all connected: human rights, racial justice, environmental justice, and the, you know, huge amount of discussion of Green New Deal, climate action. What is your take?
I was I had a great conversation with some partners and other organizations about Oregon's budget. I know approximately just over 20% of our budget is the general budget, and then usually whatever's in the general budget is matched by the federal government, right? So I think it's like it ends up being like 22-23% of our budget is like the general budget, and then we get a matching budget from the feds. And the fact of the matter is right now is that 89% of our general budget comes from income tax. And so if 1 in 7 Oregonians don't have a job, right? Like what does that mean? And then there's 5% of that comes from corporate tax. Right, that's a small percentage that comes from corporate tax, and then a small percentage that comes from property taxes. So I think the real question for me is, right, like if we get matching funds from the feds, and the majority of the majority of the income we get is from income tax, but you have all these people that don't have jobs, how do we expect to be able to do what we want to do? I mean, already there's this conversation of budgets across. A 17% cut across all of the departments. I know that's what the governor's probably going to propose 17%. She asked for 17% sort of trim the fat across all state agencies. But I think for me, it's like, okay, if we have this situation in which we're not going to have a bunch of cash to do things, then maybe it's time for us to start thinking about how we can get some more revenue. And the first thing that comes to my mind is, corporations need to start paying their fair share, right? And that's part of the Green New Deal. I think part of the Green New Deal for the nation, part of the Green New Deal for the state of Oregon is that these polluters need to pay their fair share, and they need to not just pay their fair share, but they need to chill out and stop polluting the air so damn much, especially right now, especially since COVID is a respiratory disease. And so if you're a person who lives in a community with high levels of diesel particulate matter, or you live near a point source pollution, you're already at a disadvantage. Plus compound that with COVID, and you're looking at some pretty gross soup, you know? so that's kind of what I've been thinking about, is like, you know, how can we reduce the threat of COVID? I think we can reduce the threat of COVID, sort of make Oregon a greener, better place to live, you know, begin to foster economic opportunities for low-income folks, people of color, people with disabilities, that will take the state to its next level by investing in green infrastructures, green energy jobs, so that we can increase, and also, right, like I said, tax corporations, tax polluters. I think the Green New Deal, a lot of it has to do with like, how do we fix sort of the systemic economic and racial inequities that have existed for a long time. And right now, the people who are suffering the most, who need the money the most, aren't getting it. And the people who have historically benefited the most from being polluters, from being, you know, people of a higher economic bracket, they're not really suffering. If anything, they've made a bunch of money.
Yeah, we at the Coast Range Association, we talk a lot about corporate control of forestry, private forests. There's a big piece that came out in the Oregonian. I don't know if you saw it recently. Oregonian OPB and ProPublica put out a piece about corporate forest owner tax breaks. You know, the communities, the rural communities, have just been completely given the short end of the stick on providing for their community, their people. And I'm wondering, with your experience engaging with forest workers, immigrant workers, these essential people who are working in the forests, you know, say if there's a huge investment from the federal government in Green New Deal, changing how we, you know, manage forests, storing carbon in our forests, what would the folks on the ground, the people who are doing this essential work, what would make this work in forests better for these folks on the ground?
There's a bunch of stuff, man. I mean, that's a really exciting question right now, as you mentioned, right? Like, folks in forestry get all these tax breaks, get all these cuts. I mean, right in the South, coal is king, but in the Northwest, timber is king, right? And timber has been king for a long time. And I say that also as someone who, you know, grew up and was fed with timber money. You know, my dad worked in sawmills when I was a kid. And I still have family that work in sawmills right now. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that timber, you know, doesn't give economic opportunities for people. What I will tell you is that over the last 20 or 30 years, timber has really transitioned itself to having a lot lower class and immigrant class workers. And part of the reason for that has been that they just, like, right, all the unions have been busted. All of the sort of the living wage that used to exist is no longer there. The health, sort of the healthcare, like the stuff that used to make, you know, working in timber prior to the mid 80s a great job, all that stuff's not there anymore. And that goes all the way up the chain. That goes from the person who plants the trees to the person who's thinning and cutting or doing, you know, spraying, to the folks who are in the sawmills sort of processing this wood and timber to make 2x4s and whatever else, right? The whole gambit of people who actually with their hands make the wood products that are exported across the country and across the world are not being taken care of. And that goes for their wage, that goes for their health care, and that goes for their safety, right? I had an uncle who lost an arm in 1994. Because the sawmill he worked at didn't have the right protective equipment, and his shirt got caught in this thing, and it ate up his arm up to his shoulder, and my dad had to pull his arm out. So, you know, and I have family who still works in sawmills now. You know, every few months, once a year, you know, I hear a story of someone getting their hand burned, someone's fingers getting cut off, or my dad, the people he used to do forest work for are now contractors. And you know, they talk about sort of this weird dynamic that exists, especially with a lot of, not all government contracts, but some government contracts, where sort of the person with the lowest bid gets the contract, and the person with the lowest bid usually subcontracts out and treats the workers awful, or isn't feeding them good food, or, you know, if they get hit by a tree, or they're tired, or they have bad equipment, they're kind of just brushed off to the side. So the amount of stories I've heard of people being crushed, the amount of stories I've heard of sawmills kicking back and hitting people in the face, or people dying of, you know, of dehydration or just exhaustion or heat, you know, it's just like, it's 2020, it's ridiculous. And a lot of these workers are H2A and H2B workers. So they're, that's another big transition that's been scary, has been, you know, it's one thing to have immigrants sort of working their tail off for little wages, but then when you have workers who are not from the country, who are sort of just pulled in for 9 months, 18 months to work and then sent back, you know, it's even harder for them to complain or really have a means to achieve justice. And so there's a number of things that can be done, but one of my sincere hopes is that there'll be some serious investments in protecting the health of workers, you know, to increasing the wages of workers, so that these bad actors, these bad contractors, stop trying to, you know, have a race to the bottom just so that they can throw their workers away like they're disposable. So there's a lot that can be done there. You know, I think from, like I said, from safety to wages to bids, the rock goes deep.
Those are some really important perspectives that you bring from your family and from your experience that, you know, I don't think a lot of people hear that.
No, they don't, right? A lot of folks, and I get it, right? I mean, it's I think in the front of people's minds when we think of timber, we think of, you know, protect the wolf, protect, you know, vulnerable species, which is great. Don't get me wrong. Like, but I think we need to, as much as we're advocating to protect wolves and natural habitat and, you know, estuaries and salmon and, right, like all these creatures, I think it's also to remember that, you know, this work isn't just happening by magic fairies, right? Like,
people are being exploited for the profit gain of these corporations. And yeah, it's essential to look at the whole picture and not just look at the environmental piece. You know, people are out there, communities are living off of these forests and these jobs, and then we have to look at the whole picture. You know, and that's what's really exciting about this movement around climate and forests, is because there's a real awareness of the interconnectedness that forests are can help people, can help the environment, help climate, all these things. It's all interconnected. So that's really important. I'm really happy that you were willing to take and able to take the time to chat on Coast Range Radio. Is there anything that you wanted to say that I didn't touch on? How do people get involved with your work? How do people find?
I think one thing I wanted to quickly mention before we hop the phone is that there's also this dangerous game that a lot of the industry does, which it says, like, you know, how are we going to fund schools if we don't have timber money? Right. And I think, you know this better than I, that like timber's a dying industry, right? It's not sustainable. You know, it's not sustainable at the output that we're currently doing it at. And you know, it's irresponsible to rely on such a unstable sort of revenue source to get essential services in rural communities. And so I just wanted to quickly just touch base real quick about sort of this strange thing that happens in Oregon, and in Oregon politics, where it's like rural versus the urban folks in Eugene and Portland.
In your organizing and in your work, what is your tactic for, you know, engaging rural folks, trying to bridge that divide? And what is, you know, what are your messaging? What are your talking points when you're talking about this issue? How do you bring that together? How do we deal with these justice issues, these environmental issues, climate, all these different things? How do you do that with rural folks and bridge the gap?
I think one of the things that we really need to remember, and I always tell folks this, is that, you know, I think it's right now, it's a really hard time to think about ourselves as Americans. You know, I think right now, just with how much divide there is in the nation, I think folks are, when you talk about start talking national stuff or talk about issues that you think about it in a national frame. So when you talk about climate change, you think about it in the frame of the world, the United States. When you talk about, you know, politics, you think about it in the frame of the national. So one of the things that we've really done has been to really focus on home, to focus on Oregon. And that's what I tell folks when I'm around talking about issues. I talk about, you know, like, as Oregonians, like, we have some shared values. And we do. Like, there's some things that Oregonians do and say that other folks don't. You know, I always tell folks, Oregonians are friendly people. Oregonians care about their neighbors. You know, Oregonians believe in what's fair. And, you know, and that's, I think that's the way to enter a lot of conversations, is to say, let's talk about this as Oregonians. Let's talk about this as neighbors, right? Whether you're in up and down the I-5, or you're in the coast, or you're in Central Oregon, or you're up in the Painted Hills, like the thing that connects us all is that we're proud Oregonians. And I think that's a good way to start. But yeah, no, I you know, if folks want to get involved, they can, you know, you can email me, joel@causaoregon.org. You can also reach me at my personal email, joelieboa.com. Happy to talk to anyone about, you know, any number of these issues. Yeah, you know, it's a busy time, you know, so we got to try to take things day at a time, and, you know, make sure that you're sleeping and eating and exercising, because it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? Like, we got to be in it for the long haul.
Yeah, there's a lot to be done, and it's a really important time right now. Awesome. Well, thank you, Joel. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Andrew.
Really great talking to you, and we'll Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Do you believe in the importance of community radio?
Of course I do.
Then show your support today by donating online at kboo.fm and help us meet our